Turn to Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah chapter 55, that's where...
Okay. It's good to see each and every one of you out today. I've had a good first week here in training. I've really enjoyed it a whole lot. Y'all fed me very well. I really appreciate that. But it's really good to be here this morning. If you're visiting with us, we are happy to have you with us. And let us know if there's anything that we could do for you, or if you have any questions, you can come to me or to Andy or one of the elders, and we'll be happy to answer any of the questions you have. But we're really excited that you're here with us. If you want to look at Isaiah chapter 55, and we'll be reading six, starting in verse 6. It says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his ways, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." I used to think that this verse simply meant that God is just so great, and he's so awesome, he's so much higher above us, and we can never attain how high his thoughts are, or how high his ways are. And he's just a really awesome God. That is certainly true, and you could take this from the verse, but God is saying, here are your thoughts, and here are my thoughts. That should not be the case. You need to bring your thoughts and your ways up to my ways, and bring your thoughts up to my thoughts. And it needs to be equal playing field. And that's really kind of hard to do. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, "For we walk by faith and not by sight." We can't always see the way of God's ways and the end of God's thoughts. We discussed that in Bible class today. And we're influenced by our world, by worldly wisdom, by man's wisdom, saying man's ways and man's thoughts are superior and you should go this way, and they look really enticing. But we need to trust in God's thoughts and God's ways, that he knows which way is best. And so I want to look at three examples in the Bible of men whose ways of follow God's ways. And it looked extremely foolish. It looked unwise. But they were proven faithful and rewarded for it. And kind of what did they do to follow God's ways and how they were faithful. So we're going to look at three examples today in the Bible of men who were thought foolish, but ended being faithful. The first one is Joshua. If you turn to Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. Joshua 6, starting in verse 1. "Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside, because the people of Israel, none went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand, with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, going around the city once. Thus you should do for 6 days. 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the walls shall fall down flat, and the people shall go up everyone straight before the Lord.'" So here we have Joshua, and he's given this battle plan. I want you to put yourself in Joshua's shoes. You're the new leader of the Israelites. The past leader was one of the greatest leaders to ever walk the face of the earth, Moses. So you're new. You kind of want to establish your authority a little bit. You have to present this battle plan to the Israelites, saying, "This is how we're going to conquer Jericho. We're going to walk around it 13 times and shout really loud, and all the walls are going to fall down." You have to present that. A normal plan, men, generals would have it as, well, you got to You got to surround it, make sure no food and water get into it, and build siege engines, and storm it, and build ladders, and hold out for a couple years, and then you can take it over. And that's what man's thoughts, and that's probably what the Israelites were expecting. They weren't expecting a walk around the city 13 times, and you'll conquer the city. But that's what Joshua has to present to the people of Israel. And, oh, by the way, last time you said that Joshua said that he could take the city, they tried to stone him 40 years earlier. So he's kind of a little nervous, probably, presenting this. But he does it. And I think the key to why he does it, and he is faithful, is in verse 2. Verse 2 it says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor.'" God says, "I've already given it to you." They had not been destroyed at this point. The city was still well done, and it was still together, and it was still perfect as it was. But God says, "See, it's all shut up. I've given it to you." And Joshua trusts God's promise. Now, this didn't mean that that he didn't have to go and actually go through with the battle plan and tell Israel. He still had to do that. In James chapter 2, verse 14, it says, "What good is your faith without works? Faith without works is dead." And so he still had to go and prove his faith. But he trusted in God that if he did his part and filled what God had told him to do, that God will fill his part and give the city and eventually all Canaan to Joshua. And I think it's what was as strong as faith. This morning, I realized this as we were talking about Abraham. Abraham, when he went up to sacrifice his son on the altar, he thought that he could, God could even raise him from the dead if he did have to kill him. Why? Well, it's because of the promise that he believed in. He believed so strongly in the promise of God that he was able to even kill his son if that was needed. And I think that kind of faith comes from a faith in knowledge in God's promises, that he will be faithful to his promises. So the first one is Joshua. He was faithful to go through and conquer Jericho. The second example I want to bring to you before you is in Judges. It's Gideon. In Judges chapter, starting in chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. And to give a little background, the Midianites had come and possessed the land of Israel. And because the Israelites were unfaithful to God, so he allowed the Midianites to come and take over Israel. And they were under duress from them. God sends an angel of the Lord to go find Gideon. And Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine cellar, which I don't know how you do that because you need the wind. But he's so afraid of the Midianites that he was threshing wheat in a wine cellar. And an angel comes in and says, "Behold, mighty warrior," which is very ironic because he's being quite afraid right there. And Gideon replies and says, "What? Why has God left us? You know, why is the Midianites here? What happened to the God that brought the Israelites out of Egypt?" And the Lord says, "Well, I'm fixing to rescue you, and you're going to be the guy to rescue him." And in verse 14, it says, of chapter 6, "And the Lord turned to him and says, 'Go for this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian, and do I not send you?' And he said, 'Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house.' And the Lord said to him, 'But I will be with you. You shall strike the Midianites as one.'" I'm going to key in the verse 16. It says, the Lord said to him, "But I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites." The key to all of this, this whole story, is him saying to Gideon, "I will be with you." And for the rest of chapter 6, Gideon is making him go through these kind of tests, giving him these signs that indeed the Lord will be with them. And so throughout this, and then he gets to chapter 7. And in chapter 7, he assembles his army. Gideon says, okay, I think you're with me, so I will go and attack the Midianites. And so he assembles all of Israel's fighting men together that he has, and it's 32,000. The Midianites have 135,000. So he's already at a very big disadvantage. And the Lord comes to him and says, hey, you have too many men. You need to cut down your men so anyone who is afraid can go home. And two-thirds of his army leaves. 22,000 out of the 32,000 just leave. So he's left with 10,000 people against 135,000, which, again, is not great odds at all. And then God still comes to him and says, you still have too many men. And he divides this plan. And they took him to the river, and whoever got down and lapped the water like a dog was sent home, and all who cupped the water and brought to their lips could stay. And after he did that, it was 300 men. Gideon had 300 men to take on 135,000 men. Any strategician, I'm not one, or a mathematician, would say Gideon's men are dead. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. 300 taking on 135,000 is not great odds at all. That's 495-1. They're dead. Like, in any normal battle, they're dead. And Gideon is not a soldier. He's not a military man. He's a farmer. And he's leading 300 Israelite men against this 135,000 Midianites, armored warriors. But he still is faithful. People might think he's foolish, but he still is faithful throughout it. And notice when in the beginning when he says, in chapter 6, he said, I'm the weakest. I'm no leader. I'm from the smallest tribe. I'm from the weakest. I'm the least in my father's house. And yet, even in all that, God is still faithful. And I can relate to Gideon in a lot of ways. I mean, who am I to be here before you today, preaching to 200 plus people in Minneapolis? I'm just like a small country boy from a little town in Arkansas. But I'm preaching God's word, which is, it's so vast of knowledge and so much more than I can ever comprehend. And there's people in this congregation who've studied it longer than I've been alive, who still don't get all of it. And yet, I'm before you preaching. And yet, through me and through my weakness, as through the weakness of Gideon and those 300 men, God was glorified. And God can use you and be glorified through you. No matter how weak you think you are, no matter if you were baptized last week or you've been Christian for 50 years, God can use you. And your weakness and your strength, God can use you and you can be glorified. If you have faith, if you trust in his will, if you don't trust the ways of man and the wisdom of man, but you trust the ways of God and the thoughts of God, and you follow his plan, then he can use you. And so the story of Gideon is one of great faithfulness and a spot that people would think would be, they would have no chance at all. So that's the second story. The last story I want to present to you this morning is from Hezekiah, or it's from 2 Kings, but it's about Hezekiah. In 2 Kings chapter 19, 2 Kings chapter 19, and to provide a little backstory, the Assyrians had come down and taken Israel away, captured Samaria, and Israel's gone at this point. And then a little later, a few years later, they come back again and start attacking Judea and taking all the fortified cities of Judea, and eventually surrounding the walls of Jerusalem, where Hezekiah is. And then they start reviling against the city. They start speaking bad things about Hezekiah and God, saying, you know, I've defeated this king and this king and this king and the god of that land and the god of that land and that god, the god of that land. What makes you think that your king and your god are any different? We have so much more of you. He says, we'll provide you 2,000 horses if you could put the men on them. He's just berating God and Hezekiah. And he sends a letter saying all of this to Hezekiah. And I want you to notice what Hezekiah does in chapter 19 and verse 14. Chapter 19, verse 14. Hezekiah received the letter that had from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of earth. You made the heaven and the earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open up your eyes, O Lord, and see. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste to the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. I want to point out three things from this section. One, rebellion was very much a possibility at this time. In fact, in chapter 18, in verse 31, it says Sennacherib is defiling the people of Hezekiah, and saying in verse 31 of chapter 18, do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me and come out, and then each one of you will eat of his own vine and his own fig tree. Each one of you will drink your own water from his own cistern. And so basically he's saying, hey, make your peace with me. Don't rely on Hezekiah and your God to save you. They won't, because I've defeated all these other guys. Make your peace with me, rebel against Hezekiah, and come out, and I'll let you live. You can live at your home for a time and eat your own fruit, and then I'll take you away to a great land that I have set aside for you. And so rebellion is a very, very real possibility. And any other king would have said, I have to establish my authority. I got to make sure that no rebellion happens. I got to have a plan. So what we're going to do is we're going to fortify the walls. We're going to make sure that there's no holes in our defenses, and then we're going to send an envoy to Egypt, because that's what you did in your day. You got your bigger friend to come and destroy your enemy. So we're going to send an envoy to Egypt, and we're going to try to get them to come and save us. And that's our plan, and we're going to hold strong. But that's not what Hezekiah does. Instead, he humbles himself. He puts himself in a place of weakness. He puts himself before God and says, we can't save ourselves. Only you can save us. And that kind of leads into the second point, is he prayed. He prayed to God. He said, basically, we can't do this. You have to do it. And I think that's a powerful point for us. A lot of times we have problems, we have trials, we have something that comes up in our life, challenges, and we think, well, I have to do this and do this and do this, and I got to make sure that I accomplish this, and we set aside our attack plan for how we are going to take it on. But sometimes we forget to turn to God and pray to him, and we have an ally, the most powerful being on the face of the earth and above earth and throughout the universe, on our side if we use them. In Psalms 127, it says, verse 1, unless the Lord builds the house, those who labor in it, who build it, labor in it in vain. He's basically saying this, if no matter if God is not with you, all the work and effort that you put into something is in vain, unless God is with you. And in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20, it says, now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us. We have this great being that is on our side if we simply ask him. And there's many things in the Bible that God says if we ask of him, he will freely give to us. He'll give us wisdom, and he'll give us help in temptation. He will be there for us, and in our times of trials, our times of challenges, if we simply ask and humble ourselves before God, as Hezekiah did, when we have nowhere else to go, He will help us, and you'll be there for us. And he came out, and he defended the city of Jerusalem. And all of the Syrian army was killed at that point. And then the third thing I want to notice is that it was for the glory of God. That last verse, in chapter 19, verse 19, it says, "So now, O Lord, our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, our God alone." Hezekiah didn't do it because of him. It says, "I want you to defend us so that my name will be lifted up and everybody will know my name and my power." And he didn't go after as the Syrians were killed and say, "Woo, I did this. How great am I?" He said, "This is for your name and your glory. It's not for me. I'm just a bypasser. I'm just the one to ask you. You are the one your glory is the reason that I want you to do this." And I think that's very key. That's God glory was shown in Joshua and Jericho. God glory was shown in Gideon with his 300 men, and God's glory is shown here. If people are faithful and follow God's plan, and so I know that I've kind of thrown a bunch those three stories and very quickly ran over them. But so what? Those are nice stories. Currently, I'm not trying to take a fortified city, or I don't have 135 Midianites camped in my living room. This isn't very applicable to me right now, right? The fact is that you will face challenges in your life. It may not be taking a walled city or having to liberate a nation or defending against 185 Assyrians. But you'll face trials. You'll face challenges. You'll face problems you probably already have in your life. Whether they be in your job or your family or your friends or some other aspect in your life, you will face challenges. And you have a choice. Will you listen to man's ways and man's thoughts? Will you say, "Well, she had it coming to her. Well, so you just got to do what you have to do to get ahead in this world. Well, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth." That's what I always said. Sometimes you just got to make compromises to get ahead. Or will you listen to God's ways and God's thoughts? Do you think the Assyrians thought they were smart and wise and far surpassed any nation that had previously gone? I'm sure they thought that. They thought that if their God, because their God defeated all these other gods, their God must be the greatest God ever. And yet we look back at that as like utter foolishness. I don't know a single person, I've never met a single person that still worships the gods of Assyria. Yet they thought that their wisdom was totally correct. And it's the same way with the wisdom of man today. In the postmodern world that we live in, you know, it says, your faith is correct if you really believe it in your heart, and your faith is correct if you really believe it in your heart. Which is utter foolishness. We don't do that in any other area of our life. If you go away from here and somebody asks you, "Oh, that Zach Hardesty guy, what does he look like?" You say, "Well, he was like a 5'4 Asian dude with really weird glasses." And then another guy comes to that same guy and says, "Well, who was this Zach Hardesty dude?" And he says, "Well, he was like a 7-foot black guy with really big muscles." And then a third guy comes and says, "Well, they're both true as long as you believe in your heart." I mean, that's utter foolishness, and yet that's what is broadcasted to us in religion, is that if you believe this truth is true, and this truth is true, and even though they may conflict, if you believe in your heart, it's still all right. And the same with atheism today. We believe that atheists and the leading scientists today and the smartest people on the face of the earth believe that creation, the universe, and everything you see around you, from the most complex things, came from absolutely nothing. And from nothing, it evolved to everything that it came out today. And yet, if we look at anything around us, my phone did not come from automatically drop into my desk one day and evolved into an iPhone. No, we look at that and we see it, there was a creator made that. There's obviously the work of a creator behind it. And we will look at the world around us that is so much more intricate than our iPhones or anything that we see. There's the work of the creator behind us. And yet man's wisdom is saying, no, it's not that. I can't help but wonder if 3,000 years later from this, people will look back at the world, the society around us, and think us fools for what our society believed in. And so the point I'm getting at is this. You will face challenges in your life, whether great or small. And man's wisdom will look so enticing. Everyone will say, yeah, you should do this. You should go this way. This is the way that you should live your life. These are the choices you should make. And man's wisdom, man's ways will look so great, and everybody will seem to go that way. But in the end, it's foolish. In the end, it doesn't work. It always fails. It is the men like Joshua, it is the men like Gideon, it's the men like Hezekiah, and so many more men that I could talk about in the Bible who went against and did what people thought were foolish, but in the end were proved faithful and loving, and God rewarded them for it. Those are the men who succeeded. Those are the men who got through in their life. And those are the men we need to exemplify in our lives. Because in the end, man's ways always lose and God's ways always work. There was a time in history, more than any other, that seemed like God's ways had failed. That God's ways were foolish. That God's ways didn't work. It seemed utter foolishness to have a king, to worship a God who would come down on this earth and then let himself be crucified by mere mortals that he claimed to create. And for 3 days, people thought that God's way had failed, that God's way was foolish. But to those who are faithful, God used what man thought was foolish to create the most amazing thing that's ever happened on the face of the earth. When Jesus was killed and buried for those 3 days and resurrected, he gave life to all those who are faithful. And he was faithful. He gives life to all those who are faithful to believe in him. Because in the end, every single time, God's ways win. God's thoughts win. And the decision that you have to come to is, which side do you want to be on? Do you want to be on man's ways, which lose over and over again? Or do you want to be on Joshua's side? Do you want to be on Gideon's side? Do you want to be on Hezekiah's side? Do you want to be on Jesus' side? That always win. You have a decision to make. And it's a decision that you make every day of your life with the little decisions that you make every day. Will it be man or God? Will it be foolishness or faithfulness? If we can help you in any way, you can come forward and be washed in baptism and made to walk a new life and be faithful to him. And you can be on the winning side. If you would like that to happen today, you can come forward as we stand, as we sing.